Robin mixed the hot water from the kettle into the enamel basin. It was still scalding hot. But she liked it so that it reddened the skin and left her feeling glowing with cleanliness. She began to unbutton the flannel shirt, sighing with pleasant weariness, when something scratched on the fly of the tent. "Who is it?" she called sharply, and felt a faint stir of alarm as she recognised the low voice. "What do you want?"
"I want to talk to you, missus."
Camacho's tone was conspiratorial. "Not now, I'm busy." The man repelled her, and yet in a contrary manner fascinated her as well. She had found herself staring at him more than once, as she would at a beautiful but poisonous insect. She was annoyed that he had noticed, and was vaguely aware that it was unwise to show even the vaguest interest in a man like that. "Come back tomorrow." It suddenly occurred to her that Zugo was not in the camp, and she had sent little Juba on an errand.
"I cannot wait. I am sick."
That was one appeal she could not deny. "Oh, very well. Wait," she called, and buttoned her shirt, and then as an excuse, perhaps to delay the moment, turned her attention to her instruments still spread on the table that had been carried into the tent. It reassured her to touch them and rearrange the bottles and pots of medicines. "Enter," she called at last, and faced the entrance of the tent. Camacho stooped through the entrance, and for the first time she realized how tall he was. His presence in the small tent was almost overpowering, and his smile seemed to light up the interior. His teeth were startlingly white and perfect. She found herself staring again, like a chicken, at the dancing cobra, perhaps. He was beautiful in a decadent, overblown way. He was bareheaded, all dark, dancing hair and scalding eyes. "What's the trouble?" she asked, trying to sound brisk and businesslike.
"I show you."
"Very well," she nodded, and he unbuttoned his shirt. His skin had the sheen of wet marble, but was deep olive in colour, and his body hair grew in crisply springing whorls. His belly was moulded like that of a greyhound, and his waist narrow as a girl's. She ran her eyes down his body, quite certain that her gaze was level and professional, but there was no denying the fact that he was an extraordinary animal. "Where is it?" she asked, and with a single movement, he had unclinched and lowered the light duck trousers that were all he wore on his lower body. "Where?" she asked, and realized that her voice croaked, and she could not go on with the question, for suddenly it dawned upon her that she had been the victim of a carefully planned ruse, and she was in a potentially dangerous position. "Is that where it hurts?" She found her voice was still a husky whisper. "Yes." His voice was a whisper also, and he made a slow stroking movement.
"You can fix, maybe?"
He took a step towards her. "I can fix, certainly," she said softly, and her hand dropped onto the array of surgical instruments. She actually experienced a twinge of real regret, for it was a superior example of nature's art, and afterwards she was relieved that she had selected a needle probe and not one of the razor-like scalpels that she had reached for. The instant before she stabbed, he realized what was about to happen, and an expression of utter terror blanched his swarthy, handsome face. He tried frantically to return it to whence it had come, but fear had slowed his hand. He screamed like a teenage girl as the probe lunged into him, and kept on screaming as he spun around on the same spot, as though one foot had been nailed to the ground. Now he was using both hands to hold himself, and once again, with cool professional interest, Robin noticed the quite miraculous change that had taken place. She advanced the probe once more into the ready position, and Camacho could no longer stand his ground. He snatched up his trousers and, with a last terrified howl, launched himself headfirst into the tent pole. The collision checked him only a moment, and then he was gone, and Robin found herself trembling violently. And yet she was strangely elated. It had been an unusual and instructive experience. However, she would have to use her own personal code when describing it in her journal. From that evening onwards, the Portuguese kept well away from Robin, and she was relieved not to have those hot, dark eyes caressing her wherever she turned. She thought of telling Zuger of the incident, but decided that the embarrassment to both of them and the difficulty of finding the correct words was not worth it. Then there would be the extreme reaction which Zuger would almost certainly have, or that she expected he would have. She had learned never to expect the obvious reaction from her brother. Behind the cool and reserved exterior, she suspected there existed mysterious passions and dark emotions. After all, they were full-blooded brother and sister, and if she was so afflicted, why should he not be also? On the other hand, she suspected that, like a cornered wild animal, the Portuguese could be a grave danger, even to an experienced soldier and man of action like Zuger. She had a horror of forcing her brother into a position which might lead, if not to his death, then at least to serious injury. Besides which, she had effectively taken care of the man herself. He would be no further trouble, she decided comfortably, and she dismissed Camacho from her mind, and concentrated instead on the pleasure of the last few leisurely days of the voyage upstream. The river had narrowed, and the flow was swifter, so that the rate of the convoy's advance slowed even further. The banks provided an ever-changing panorama. Sitting under the awning with Zuger sketching or writing beside her, she was able to call his attention to the new birds and trees and animals, and to have the benefit of his knowledge, gathered, to be sure, mostly from books, but still wide-reaching and interesting. The hills of the escarpment rose in a series of coxcombs, so two-dimensional that they seemed to be cut out from thin sheets of some opaque material that allowed the colours of the sunrise to glow through with a weird luminosity. As the sun rose higher, the colours washed out to ethereal eggshell blues, and finally faded altogether in the heat haze of midday, to reappear in the late afternoon in a new suit of totally different colours, pale pinks and ash of roses, ripe plum and delicate apricot. The hills formed a backdrop to the forests that now ran in a narrow belt along the river banks. Tall galleries of trees, with spreading upper branches in which the troops of vervet monkeys frolicked. The trunks of these trees were daubed with multicoloured lichens, sulphurous yellows, burnt oranges and the blues and greens of a summer sea. The tangled ropes of lianas, which as a child Robin had called monkey ropes, dangled down from the upper branches to touch the surface of the river or cascade into the dense dark greens of the undergrowth. Beyond this narrow strip of vegetation, there were occasionally glimpses of a different forest on the higher, drier ground. And Robin saw again with a sharp nostalgic pang the ugly and bloated baobab tree with its scrubby, bare little branches topping the huge, swollen stem. The African legends that her mother had repeated to her so often explained how the Nkulukulu, the Great Great One, had planted the baobab upside down with its roots in the air. Nearly every baobab had a nest of one of the big birds of prey in its bare branches, each a shaggy mass of dried twigs and small branches looking like a small airborne haystack. Often the birds were at the nest site, sitting on a lookout branch with that typical raptorial stillness, or soaring above in wide circles, with only an occasional lazy flap of the spread wings and the stiff tip feathers feeling the air currents like the fingers of a concert pianist upon the ivory keys. There was very little game along this part of the river, and the rare antelope rushed back into cover at the first distant approach, a pale blur of movement, with a mere fleeting glimpse of the tall corkscrew horns of a great kudu, or the flirt of the white powder-puff underside of a reedbuck's tail. The game close to the river had been heavily hunted, if not by the Portuguese themselves, then by their armed servants, for nearly 200 years. When Zuga asked Camacho, "Do you ever find elephant on this part of the river?" the Portuguese had flashed his smile and declared, "If I find him, I kill him." A sentiment that was probably shared by nearly every traveller along this busy waterway, and which accounted for the timidity and scarcity of the game in the area. Camacho was reduced to firing at the roosting fish eagles on their fishing perches overhanging the water. These handsome birds had the same snowy white head, breast and shoulders of the famous American bald eagle, and a body of lovely dark russet and glistening black. When a shout of Camacho's laughter signalled a hit, A bird would tumble untidily over its disproportionately large wings as it fell into the green water, reduced from imperial dignity to awkward and ungainly death by the strike of the lead bullet. Within a few days, Camacho had recovered from the peculiar bow-legged and deliberate gait with which he favoured the injury that Robin had inflicted on him, and his laughter regained its ringing timbre. But there were other injuries that did not heal so readily, those to his pride and his masculinity. His lust had been changed on the instant to burning hatred, and the more he brooded upon it, the more corrosive it became, and the deeper his craving for vengeance. However, his personal considerations would have to wait. There was still much important work for him to do. His uncle, the governor of Quelimane, had placed great trust in him by assigning him to this task, and his uncle would be unforgiving of any failure. The family fortune was involved, and to a lesser extent, the family honour, although this last was a commodity that through constant attrition had lost much of its lustre. However, the family fortunes had suffered considerably since Portugal had been forced to heed the Brussels Treaty. What was left to the family had to be protected. Gold before honour, and honour only when it does not affect the profits. This might have been the family motto. His uncle had been perceptive, as always, in recognising in this English expedition a further threat to their interests. It was, after all, headed by the son of a notorious troublemaker, who could be expected to aggravate the enormous damage done by the father. Furthermore, nobody could be sure of the real objects of the expedition. Major Ballantyne's assertion that it was an expedition to find his missing father was, of course, utterly absurd. That explanation was much too simple and direct, and the English were never simple or direct. This elaborate expedition must have cost many thousands of English pounds, a huge sum of money, far beyond the means of a junior army officer, or the family of a missionary whose futile effort to navigate the Zambezi had ended in disgrace and ridicule, a sick old man who must have perished years ago in the uncharted wilderness. No, there was another motive for all this activity, and the governor wanted to know what it was. It was, of course, possible that this was a clandestine reconnaissance by an officer of the British Army ordered by his overbearing government. Who knew what outrageous designs they had upon the sovereign territory of the glorious Portuguese Empire? The avarice of this impudent race of shopkeepers and tradesmen was scarcely to be believed. The governor did not trust them, despite their traditional alliance with Portugal. On the other hand, it might indeed be a private expedition. But the governor never lost sight of the fact that it was led by the son of that notorious old busybody who had possessed the scavenging eye of a vulture. Who knew what the old devil had stumbled upon out there in the unknown land? A mountain of gold or silver? The fabled lost city of Monomotapa with all its treasures intact? Anything was possible. Of course, the old missionary would have sent news of the discovery to his own son. If there was a mountain of gold out there, then the governor would be very pleased to know about it. Even if there were no treasures to discover, there were certainly old ones to protect. It would be Camacho Pereira's duty to steer the expedition away from certain areas to prevent it stumbling on secrets known not even to the governor's masters in Lisbon. Camacho's orders were clear. Distract the Englishman by accounts of the insurmountable difficulty of travel in certain directions, the swamps, the mountain ranges, the disease, the savage animals, and even more savage men, and contrast that with the friendly people in pleasant lands rich with ivory that lay in other directions. If this was unsuccessful, and Major Ballantyne had all the earmarks of arrogance and intractability peculiar to his nation, then Camacho was to use what other means of persuasion came to hand. This was a euphemism perfectly understood by both the governor and his nephew. Camacho had almost convinced himself that this was really the only sensible course of action. Beyond Tet, there was no law except that of the knife, and Camacho had always lived by that law. Now he savoured the thought. He had found the Englishman's unconcealed contempt as galling as the woman's rejection had been painful. He had convinced himself that the reason for the attitude towards him, of both brother and sister, was his mulatto blood. This was a sensitive area of Camacho's self-esteem, for even in Portuguese territories, where miscegenation was almost universal practice, mixed blood still carried a stigma. he would enjoy the work ahead. For not only would it wipe out the insults he had suffered, but it would bring rich pickings. And even after they had been shared out with his uncle and others, there would still be much profit in it for himself. The equipment that the expedition carried represented, in Camacho's view, a vast fortune. There were barge loads of excellent trade goods. Camacho had taken the first opportunity to check secretly the contents of the packs. There were firearms and valuable instruments, chronometers and sextants, and there was a forged steel field safe that the Englishman kept locked and guarded. The merciful God alone knew how many golden English sovereigns it contained, and if he did not know, then his good uncle, the governor, knew less. It would make the division of the spoils more in Camacho's favour. The more he brooded upon it, the more he looked forward to the arrival at Tete and the jump-off into the unexplored territory beyond.